Today's date is October 29, 2010. We're at the Amelia Island Museum of History. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Heritage Keepers Project. We are interviewing Charles Nims Corbin. Date of birth, December 25, 1945. Place of birth, Keene, New Hampshire. My name is Robert Hamer, and I will interview Mr. Corbett on behalf of the museum. Assisting me is Sue Ann Tam and Bobby Foster, who will be operating the recording equipment. We will now begin the interview process. Charlie, let's start by you telling us what it was like to grow up in Fernandina.
My earliest recollections of Fernandina were we lived at the beach North Fletcher Avenue. Our house actually is still there. It's the very first house on North Fletcher Avenue. We would play in the ocean, play at the beach every day. In the summertime, our attire was shorts and underwear. That was it. Actually, in 1955, we moved to town to the present location at 106 North 15th Street.
Gotcha.
Also at that time, my earliest recollection, of course, of working was I worked at Nassau Fertilizer and Oil, which was my father's business. He was manager, secretary, treasurer there.
Mm-hmm. And your father's name?
It was Eckstein Corbett, known as the X-Man. My first job there was I was a commissary clerk. I stocked shelves for our boats.
Okay.
We had, at that time we had four fishing boats.
Do you remember the names of the boats by any chance?
The boat names of the boats were actually the Barbette, the Laura Key, the Storm King, and the Tracy Corbett. Mm-hmm. Were the four boats that we used at that time.
Do you happen to remember the captain's names or any of the crew?
Well, Tracy Corbett was captained by Lou Loki, Arbet, Otis Snooky Jones. That was his nickname.
Mm-hmm.
And the Larkeet was Telford Gaskell. And I'm not sure about the other. We had several other different captains.
Mm-hmm. Charlie, was the Tracy Corbett named after someone in your family?
It was named after my uncle, T.J. Corbett, Tracy James Corbett, who was my uncle and who had been secretary treasurer of the at the Pokey plant since 1926. And actually, at this time, I'd like to give a little history of the Menhaden business in town, if that's permissible.
Sure. And Menhaden, is that Pokey? Is that what we?
Menhaden's the official name of Pokey. The fish.
Great.
That they caught, and Pokey is a localized name.
Gotcha.
But the my family's been involved with the with Nassau Fertilizer since 1924. Menhaden fishing business actually came to Fernandina in 1912. It was known as the Seminole Fertilizer and Oil Company. And in 1921, a gentleman by the name of James B. Guest, Jr., from Denmark, South Carolina, bought the Pokey plant and went Pokey fishing. In 1924, my uncle, T.J. Corbett, came from Two Egg, Florida, which is in the Panhandle.
Mm-hmm.
And he came over and worked, and then in 1926, he was made auditor, and he remained in that capacity until his untimely death in 1949.
Mm-hmm.
And then my father, Eckstein Corbett, became secretary treasurer, and he remained in that capacity until 1986, when my brother, he semi-retired, and actually he retired in 1986, and my brother took over, and he remained secretary treasurer until the present day, 2010.
And what is your brother's name?
My brother's name is James S. Corbett. He's now president of Nassau Fertilizer and Oil. And my other brother, Thomas Corbett, is secretary treasurer.
Mm-hmm.
So our family's been in the Menhaden business since 1924.
Okay, hold on.
Charlie, if you could, just for a second here, why don't you tell us about the industry? I don't think a lot of people know really what pogie fishing is and the boats and the whole process. Why don't you just take a minute and give us that backstory?
Okay, actually, menhaden fishing, originally, as it says in the name, Nassau Fertilizer and Oil, was used for fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
What you would do would have a big one big boat. Most of them were between 90 and 120 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
And you had two purse boats in which you would have, you had a purse seine net in which you would use a, originally we used crow's nests, which are a high thing on the boat to spot schools of fish.
Mm-hmm.
Later we use airplanes. Mm. Airplanes spotted these schools. If you've seen pictures of them, you look on the water, it's usually a dark school of fish on the water, easy to spot, especially from the air.
Mm-hmm.
And once you would do what was called a set.
Mm-hmm.
And a set, you would set the nets around the school of fish.
Gotcha.
Then bring the big boat up beside the purse boats. Originally, a net was thrown over the side with a bucket-type net, and you would dip the fish out into the holes. Later, after it became mechanized, you had pumps that would pump the fish on board. And once you had a hole full of fish, you'd bring them back to the plant and process them. And the process consisted of you would pump them out of the hole of the boat into what we call a raw box, where they were located. It was just a big tank that you would put all the fish in, suck the water out of it, so you just have the fish. Then the fish were cooked, and you use a centrifuge to take out, to separate the fish meal, the oil, and then the liquids, which was called solubles. That was the three parts that you would use. Now the meal itself would go into a warehouse where it would cool, be turned over. When I say turned over, there's a pulley system that went around and cool the meal off because you just had it cooked, and then it became meal. The oil would go into another tank, which you would have the oil, and then the solubles would go into another tank, which would be initially would be about 90% liquid. And you would put it into a system that you would cook off the liquid and bring it down to as only about 40% liquid.
Mm-hmm.
After doing this, the fish meal originally was used for fertilizer. After artificial fertilizers came in, it was used for chicken feed.
Mm-hmm.
Very high protein, make the chickens grow twice as fast in half the time.
Mm-hmm.
The oil itself was used in a lot of cosmetics. The sheen in your lipstick was one of the things. We used to sell fish oil to Revlon, for instance. The solubles were put back into the fish meal because they were very, very high in protein. Another use for the oil was, couldn't be used in this country, but after World War II, a lot of the oil, was, because it was a natural ingredient, was shipped to Europe and put in margarine.
Hmm.
So those were basically the products that we had. What the products that we used for the fish meal.
Gotcha. So the fish.
Time out a minute. Yeah. Go ahead.
If we could, Charlie, can we come back to the boats for a little while? Can we talk about the technology on the boat, the size of the crew, the makeup of the crew?
In the 40s and 50s we fished four boats, and later on we went down to three.
Mm-hmm.
But as I told you, all the boats were between 90 and 120 feet long. Most were crewed with our crews on our purse boats were about 32 persons apiece. And we also would have a captain, assistant captain and engineer on the base.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, as we got a little bit technically innovative, we had a gentleman by the name of John Robus, who was a local person here. He actually at one time owned the barbette, and he was in the pogey business himself. And he came up with an idea to use a power block on the purse boats,
mm-hmm.
to help reel in the nets. Before, you would have to have 32 men, in which you would have to have basically about all of them would have been on the nets, pulling the nets in rhythm, which is where you get
the sea chanties.
They would all pull in unison, because those nets had to be brought in and layered. You know, they grab it, bring it in, and layer it so that obviously when they put it back out, it wouldn't become tangled, because they could do more than one set a day and one set on a school of fish, depending on how large the fish was. So they would use the canties to for the rhythm and that. And originally you had to have 32 men, because when there was a full net, it was very heavy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Mr. Robus came up with this power block idea, which would basically is a generator on a boat, and it would pull a net. You still needed a crew of 16 to make sure the net was brought in and layered right.
Mm-hmm.
But
what about the makeup of the crew, and what was their age demographic?
Basically, in the early day, most all our crews on the purse boats were African American.
Hmm.
We also had actually one of the first, a gentleman by the name of Neil Frank was one of the first African American pogey captains, at least in the Fernandina area.
Wow.
We had other captains were white, but most were African Americans on the purse boats.
Was it a young man's job? Or?
Originally, it would have been a young man's job, but as pogey fishing went on, we normally retained the same crews and became older and older,
mm-hmm.
as you went along. I mean, the crews didn't change too much, and they became older.
Yeah.
I mean, each captain had basically his own crew, and he'd retain that crew every season when they went fishing. I mean, we usually normally only fished March to September,
mm-hmm.
maybe a little bit into October.
Was it a good paying job to be on board?
I think in those times you were paid by what they called a dump. Now, that may sound derogatory, but...
How much fish did you...
The fish, actually, what you had, when the fish were pumped off the boat, they were pumped into before they went into the raw box, they were put into a four-compartment dump. A triangular shape. Each compartment is triangular shape.
Mm-hmm.
And when that compartment filled up, that was one dump. It's supposed to be approximately, I believe, 1,000 fish.
Gotcha.
And then... You would turn that over. It was on a wheel, and you would turn that over. And at Cannon 1, that's how the fishermen were paid.
Gotcha.
They would be paid, say, if you were your regular fisherman, you may get 8 cents a dump.
Gotcha.
And if you were the captain, you may get 20.
Mm-hmm.
Engineer may get 15.
Gotcha.
But that's how they were paid.
And how long was a typical day? When you were out, did they start early in the morning? And
yes, they would obviously start before they would. The crews would get on board way before dawn, 2-4 o'clock in the morning, something like that, because they had to get out. And normally, the best time to make set on fishes was right at dawn,
mm-hmm.
or early morning. That's when the fish were schooled up. It's also normally, if you've seen the Atlantic out there, it can be like a lake out there in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
In the afternoons, it kicks up. Fairly rough, hard to make a set.
Mm-hmm.
So they would normally get on the boats. They had bunks on the boats. The crews would sleep. The captain and the engineer would take them out to where the fish were, and then they would start. You know, if the spotter plane spotted the fish, they would put them on them for a set, and then they would normally work in the mornings. Occasionally, they would stay out overnight if there were more fish out. Normally, they like to fill the hole before they came in, because obviously fuel was at a premium even in the old days. And you go out and come back. Now, if they're fishing offshore here, they could come back in and deliver the fish. But if they had to go to someplace like Sapelo Island, which is north of St. Simons, they would stay out overnight. They could stay out overnight, and then they would bring them back in.
What was the average wage that somebody working on a boat would earn? Do you have any idea what average weekly wage?
Probably in the old days, $50 to $100, $125.
That sounds like a pretty decent wage.
It was. Now, they basically, like I said, they only fished 6 months out of the year.
Oh, that's true.
So, but when they worked on the boats and there were fish available, yes, it was pretty profitable at that time.
Mm-hmm. Charlie, at the height of the menhaden industry, about how many people worked for Nassau Fertilizer Oil and Oil on the ships?
Let's see, we had four boats that you had. Probably between 250 and 300 people.
Wow.
Because we had four boats, and we also had plant. There weren't many people in the plant. But four boats, it's 64 probably on a purse boat. This would have been way back. Later on, it would have been 16, 32, 35. And we only had three boats. That'd be about 100. So you're talking a lot less.
And do you recall about when did you start using airplane spotters?
That would have been in the 1950s.
And would this airplane spotter and the airplane, was that owned by Nassau Fertilizer and Oil?
Originally, we did own the plane. We bought a plane and we had our own pilot. But later on, as it became a little more expensive, what we would do would be to we would lease a pilot for during the fishing season. It's more economically sensible to do that because we only had a 6 month season, and we would find a pilot and he would fly for us and we would lease the plane from him and his plane, and that's how we did it.
And where would he have taken off from when he did that?
Fernandina Beach Airport.
Fernandina Beach Airport.
He kept his plane out there, and that's where he would have flown out of. I've flown with them several times. Most of the planes at least were two-seater. Occasionally we'd have a four-seater, depending on the plane we leased. And he would go up and be up at dawn, you know, when there's visibility, and he would look for schools. Or in some cases, he would take off late in the afternoon or the day before and go out and scout and look for schools, in which the next morning he would go back up again and know the site he'd seen the day before. They don't move too much. I mean, obviously they would move some overnight, but not much. And then he would the next morning when the boats were out, he would put the boats on the Menhaden.
Do you happen to remember the names of any of the pilots?
That's a good question.
Was there a Bowman?
Possibly. One of them lived next door to us, but I can't remember his name now.
Charlie, you said that the plant closed in the mid-1980s. Why did it close, and when? Well, why don't you just tell us why it?
Well, actually, as the years went along, the Menhaden became younger, which meant there were less oil out of them. Also, there were less menhaden here. The actual reasoning for us closing, we actually closed the fishing part. The rest of the plant's still there. And actually, even after we closed, we still made chicken feed there using imported menhaden from South America. But actually, the reason we closed during the 80s, we had an odor. We always had the odor, but the EPA came in and said we had to eliminate that odor in the air, We had to put a furnace in, of which was the first of its kind in Florida, mainly because we were the only Menhaden plant still left in Florida. And the furnace would not burn 100% of the odor up. It finally, after 10, maybe 15 years in operation, it finally deteriorated to the point that we were going to have to put a new one in, and the new one would have been basically cost prohibitive for us to continue operations at that present time. So we were able to, we were lucky and able to sell. We actually sold the one remaining boat we had, which was known as the Jim Guess, which is named after the founding father of Nassau Fertilizer. And we went into the, we rent docks and lease warehouses, which we do to this present day.
Now, when the industry was cranking along, did Nassau Fertilizer and Oil do a whole operation? In other words, did you manufacture, market, retail, distribute? Did you do all of that, or did you work with a supplier? Or not a supplier, a retailer?
We actually, we were the wholesale end of it. We, caught the product, manufactured the product, and sold it. Basically, the way we sold it, the meal was sold in bulk. The oil was sold in bulk. We also did some bagging, 100-pound bags of fertilizer, which we sold directly to retailers, which they used as fertilizer. And then later on, we sold some that they used for chicken feed.
So the brand name on it would have been Nassau Fertilizer and Oil?
It's called, actually, the when it was fertilizer, it was called Nassau brand. And then later on, when we had a name for our chicken feed, it was called ProPak. It was high in protein. And we had a gentleman from the University of Georgia came up with a formula. We used a lot more than just fish meal. Since we had fish meal available right there, we mixed it right there. And we had fish meal. We also used feather meal, blood meal, and some preservative, obviously, for that. But it was different. There were probably about five different meals that we combined, with probably 80% of it being fish meal, and which we made a product called ProPak, which we sold to chicken farmers. Basically, in the at that time, we sold some in the Tampa, Florida area. There were a lot of chicken farms down around that area, and then in the Gainesville, Dahlonega, Georgia area. Where we sold it.
How did you transport your product off the island?
We had truck that we and also railroad car.
Mm-hmm.
We would load railroad cars, basically the railroad that ends right by container.
Mm-hmm.
The railroad would bring in empty cars there, hopper cars. If you're familiar with a hopper car,
yep.
You load it in the top, comes out the bottom.
Sure.
And we would we had a truck that had that we could load fish meal on it, and then we had a funnel type thing that you loaded into the hopper cars. So it went out by either truck or railroad.
In the height of your time, do you remember how many trucks and trains would go out a day? Was it a lot of product on it?
In the summer when we were fishing, we basically did it by car. We might send out two or three cars. I probably not as much as a day, but we'd send two or three a weekend.
Okay.
Maybe as many as five, depending on where we were going. And then we did a truck. We actually had one truck that we delivered to smaller dealers,
mm-hmm.
Smaller chicken farms.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a pretty good safety record with your boats in the plant?
Yeah, we never not a single boat sunk, so that's always a good sign.
Well, looking at the shrimp boats that have gone down here, that's really something. I mean, that you didn't lose any boats to storms.
We actually had the only thing we had I believe it was the Tracy Corbett. We had a fire on the Tracy Corbett, and that's the only thing that I remember. And I think we had one boat go up on the shore one time, but we got it off. So other than that, Never lost any boats during a storm or at sea. Mm-hmm. Pretty good sized boats. I mean, they were, like I said, 90 to 120 feet.
Yeah.
So they were good sized boats. And, you know, we didn't, most of the bogey fishing is done actually right offshore here. A lot of it was done within 100 feet of the shore. In fact, sometimes once we did get a boat up on the shore, the captain got too far ashore, put it on the ground, had to wait for the high tide, we got him back off.
Was it a union-run facility?
No.
So everybody wasn't a union issue or anything?
No.
Like that.
Okay. No. It was all
work conditions
free
were
work.
Acceptable, and everybody was.
Well, they had a choice. They could either. Most of them were pogey fishermen. We were the only pogey factory in town, so they had a choice.
This is it.
Work or not work.
This is it. If you could, can you tell us what you personally did at the plant through the years?
Well, as I said, my first job was we had a commissary. A lot of companies at that time had commissaries, and in fact, some of the coins that you see here at the museum, those coins were used to purchase stuff from the commissary. I mean, that was the money that the cook on the boats would use to purchase foodstuffs. And what we had a commissary in which that we my first job probably about 10 years old would be we used to get beans, rice, coffee, sugar, and they would all come in big bags that you would break down into little bags inside. But my job was to fill the shelves with the little bags, and then when the cook came in, he would, you know, get about 2 sugars, 2 coffees, 3 beans, some rice, mm-hmm. and he would, then I would write his order up and mm-hmm. everything. And then my job was to sweep out the commissary and all of that. And then later on when I was older, I worked in the what they call a scrap shed, which was where the meal would come down. And we would bag 100-pound sacks. And we'd bag those, stack them on pallets, and then you'd also load trucks. We'd have trucks come in, and you'd load. This was just for bags, and we would load 100-pound bags on the trucks. But my main job, one of my jobs was somewhat unusual. I was a fish counter. I would be the one that would count the fish, and like as I stated previously, in the dumps, I would count the fish, and I was the official fish counter, which is how the guys got paid. So they particularly come up and make sure I didn't miss a dump as a fish went into the raw box.
Did you have like a clicker kind of a thing?
Or? Oh, I had a bell actually.
Okay.
Had a little bell with a counter on it, and every time you'd ring it, it would ding.
Oh, no kidding.
So therefore, they didn't actually have to come in the little house up there. They could stand outside and listen to the dings and make sure that every one of them went on.
Where did that bell end up? Any idea?
I have no idea. That was torn down a long time ago, and you know when we stopped fishing, we tore most of that equipment out of there. So I don't have any idea.
Just for clarification, though, Charlie, the commissary it's basically supplied the ships or the boats, rather. Is that what I'm?
It was for the boats. Yeah, at that time we had 4 boats. Yeah. And each cook, the cook would come in and I'd write it up, and then I'd give it to the secretary and secretary treasurer, and then he'd take the food out of their paychecks at the end of the week. That's how they.
So the cooks were on the boats, or the
cooks were on. Head, yeah.
Okay, so you didn't.
We
cook.
Had a galley on the boats.
Gotcha. Okay, and so it would be customary to provide breakfast and lunch to the crew.
Well, it's like I said, they would leave at 2 in the morning, depending mm-hmm. on how far they had to go.
Right.
Well, the cook would be on, and he would have coffee, and then he'd have breakfast for them, and then. You know, they would stay out, and you know, if they were out past noon, he would cook lunch for them. So
sure.
They had meals right on board. They had a galley with a little dining area on there,
yeah.
And then bunks for them to sleep in when they were going out. So
just thank you. I want to put it together.
Charlie, as the industry sort of winded down, where did the fishermen go for employment after that? Do you know?
You know, that's a good question. This was, of course, all the years that we were out there was, you know, during segregation. And so I guess, you know, we were one of the largest employers of African Americans in the county at that time. in all honesty, by the time we retired, most of the fishermen were probably in their 60s. A lot of them retired. A lot of them drew Social Security. The few younger ones were there. At that time, in the 80s, segregation was gone. Some went to work in the paper mills. I know we had a few that ended up going into the shrimping business because they were still fishermen. They still owned the boats. And a few of them went into that. But basically, when the industry went out, the fishermen did too, because most of them were, like I said, most of them actually were in their 60s, so they would have been able to retire, or if not, soon enough. So that's basically what most of them did.
Did most of the fishermen live in Old Town or near the Pogie plant?
The way it worked was we processed all the fish out at the Pogie plant. The boats were actually tied up down here at the Cook Docks.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Because next door to the Cook Docks was where the fueling was. A gentleman by the name of Hugh Stone had, I believe it was Gulf, but I'm not 100% sure. But that's where they fueled. So they would come to the plant in the afternoon, unload the fish, and then they would bring the boats downtown here, and they would dock at the Cook Docks and refuel. You'd be ready to go out in the morning. And most of the fishermen lived downtown in the area down here between, Front and 11th Street. Most of them lived there, and a lot of them had bicycles, and they would ride back and forth on the bicycles. And the captain would come and pick some of them up. But they were down here. Actually, most of the people that worked in the Pogie plant, processing and that type, lived in Old Town. And originally, before they put roads in, they had a bridge that went over Egan's Creek from Old Town to the peninsula where the Pogie plant is. That's how they got to work. And most of those people that actually worked in the Pogie plant, not on the boats, but in the Pogie plant, lived in Old Town. But most of the fishermen, in fact, almost all the fishermen, lived downtown here.
When I was going over some old newspapers, I found the bridge over North 14th Street was approved to be built by FDOT in March of 1960.
Hmm. Yeah, that's correct. What was there before that, what was there were two dikes, basically, that they would let the water out from Egan's Creek but would not let it in. That's why at Egan's Creek there, that was all dry land. Except for where the creek is, the rest of that land was dry between there and the fort. That was dry land there. And when they opened the bridge, we used to call it the bridge to nowhere because it only went to the Pogie plant.
Now, there was a landing strip along Egan's Creek, wasn't there?
That's correct.
But that didn't have anything to do with the Pogie plant.
No. No, actually, I can't remember the guy's name, but there was a landing strip there right after World War II from about 46 to 48, maybe 49. Johnny Haverstick was actually the name of the gentleman that had that. And it ran north-south right along Egan's Creek, on the north side of Egan's Creek. But it didn't have anything to do with the Pogie plant. As far as I know, we did not use... We used crow's nest at that time and not airplanes to spot the fish.
Was the plant well received by the community?
Only when the wind wasn't blowing from the northwest.
You want to talk about that a little bit, though? I mean, that's a reality, right?
Well, I'll tell you a little story on that. Between the paper mills, and we had a crab factory down here at that time, and we had the Pogie plant. So you could always tell the tourists that were downtown, because when they come walking out from the shops and buildings, they'd be grabbing their face and hitting it, they would think something was on them, and they'd be trying to get it off of them because the odor was somewhat odoriferous, to say the least.
Charlie, reflecting back, about the pogie business, your boats and things like that. Are there any other stories that you'd like to share with us about that timeline?
Well, to be honest with you, there was one little thing that we had going on with us. In 1991, mm-hmm. there was a boat called the Arctic Explorer, and it was actually the exploration ship that found what was at the SS Central America, which mm-hmm. sunk in a hurricane in 1856 off of Charleston, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Now, the significance of that sinking was it was a boat that had come from the Isthmus of Panama carrying a load of gold that the from California that had been minted by the San Francisco Mint, which had just come into production, and was taking a boatload of gold to Washington, D.C. I believe it was Washington or New York. Anyway, the one boat had come from San Francisco around to the Isthmus. They had offloaded the gold, taken it across on a railroad car, and loaded it onto the SS Central America, which was on its way to New York, I think, when it sank off of Charleston, South Carolina. The significance of that being that the Arctic Explorer, which used our docks out there at front at Nassau Fertilizer as a staging area to go look for this for this boat, and then later on it was berthed there for several years. So we do have a little historical significance with that. And the gold was at that time, and I still believe it to this day, was the biggest amount of gold ever found in a boat. And most of the gold was still in a lot of the wrappers around what the gold had been packed in had decayed, but the gold was still in stacks at the bottom of the ocean. And I don't know how many, maybe up to $1 billion worth of gold.
Wow.
Jeez. And anyway, but that was a little bit of historical significance out there that we had. It was part of that, which you won't find anywhere else.
Very impressive. Very impressive. Let's change gears just a little bit. Let's go back to you. You're born in Keene, New Hampshire. How old were you when you came to the Fernandina area? One question. Second question, tell us a little bit more about your family, too.
Well, I actually was born in Keene. I'll give you a quick background on that. During World War II, when my father went overseas, my mother was pregnant. She was actually from Keene, New Hampshire, so she went back to be with her parents. And I was actually born there, and as soon as World War II was over, or my father got out of World War II, he came, got us, and we came to Fernandina, which was where he was from.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how that transpired.
Gotcha.
Originally, my family was from Two Egg, Florida,
mm-hmm.
which is in the Panhandle near Chattahoochee, Florida.
Mm-hmm. What did your father do for work?
My father actually was, let me think.
After he got out of the service.
Actually, when my father got out of the service, he was a postman.
Oh, really?
He worked for the Postal Service from 45 to 49. My uncle actually came to Fernandina in 1924
mm-hmm.
to work at the pogie plant.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1926, he became auditor out there, and he remained that until 1949 when he died an early death from complications from asthma.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the gentleman, Mr. Guest, asked my father if he would like to come out there and become secretary, treasurer, manager. So he went to work out there in 1949.
Mm-hmm.
And was a pretty prominent person here in the community. He was in the Fernandina Beach City Commission from mm-hmm. approximately 52 to 58,
mm-hmm.
during which the golf course
This
is my father, okay. Eckstein Corp.
Okay.
And he was also involved in having the recreation center built, which I believe was built in 1956.
Wow.
So a lot of the present things that we have here in the city, he and a gentleman by the name of Paul Burns were very prominent in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And then his progressive nature got the best of him, so after his second term, he was voted out of office.
Yeah.
Anyway. And But he remained manager of Nassau Fertilizer until 1986.
Gotcha.
When my brother actually worked for him. My brother started out there in 1978, and he worked, became manager in 86, and he's now president, mm-hmm. and he's there to the present day.
What about your mom? Did she stay at home? Did she work?
My mom was a stay-at-home mom.
Gotcha.
She took care of us at the house and, you know, the usual things, Little League and scouting and that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But she stayed at home.
Mm-hmm.
And what was her name?
My mother's name was Priscilla. Priscilla, and she was from a family in Keene, New Hampshire. They actually met at USO in Atlanta, Georgia, which is interesting because not only did my mother my father meet my mother, another gentleman here in Fernandina by the name of John Barniak met his wife at the USO in Atlanta, Georgia during World War II.
Wow.
So it's interesting facts
that
two people, you know, met there from Fernandina, met their wives there.
Sure. Now, you had mentioned earlier that you, when you were younger, you worked a little bit in different facets at the plant. But what was your career? What did you do for...
Basically, I graduated from Florida State University. I went in the military and then... came out and was a salesman in different capacities. When I initially came out, I actually worked in a restaurant as assistant manager, and then I ran a wine and cheese shop for a year.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I know just enough about wine and cheese to be dangerous.
Charlie, did any of your children or your nieces or nephews stay involved with the hoagie business?
No. We don't have any. This is the last generation over. All the rest of them decided to seek their fortune elsewhere.
I'd like to know what it was like growing up in Fernandina. Do you have any memories, fond or not so fond, about life here?
Well, you know, being on an island, basically when we were younger kids, we'd leave the island twice a year. Once in the fall to go get school clothes in Jacksonville, and then once at Christmas to get Christmas presents. The rest of the time, we basically would roam the island. And if you went to the south end of the island, you know, that would be a day trip.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
What was at the south end of the island?
Nothing. Basically, that was owned by 3M Company at the time. They were going to phosphate mine that. Luckily, they never did. And basically, you go to the south end of the island to fish. Either, you know, fish with a pole, seine fish, mm-hmm. Flounder gig, and that's basically what you did down there. And we used to do a lot of seining here. And the tall guy would, of course, be out in the deep water, and he'd set the seine up on the shore and then take it around and sweep it around. But a lot of fishing, a lot of beach fishing. At that time, a lot of baseball. Everybody played Little League or attempted to.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, everybody knew everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, either your parents worked at the mill, or they were in the fishing business, or they had a few people downtown. But I mean, my graduating class was 94 people, and I knew every single one of them, and you probably were real good friends with over half of them.
What were the beaches like? Main Beach? Were there things for you to do there at the beach?
Actually, at the time, there were quite a bit more stuff to do at Main Beach than there is now.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, this would have been in the 50s and early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
We had a skating rink. We had trampolines. The putt-putt, actually, that's still there now, was in there in mm-hmm. the same spot. We had Moore's Grocery.
Mm-hmm.
It was a grocery store. Of course, at that time it was Moore's Grocery. There was a Moore's Bar, and then there was a what we call a bowling center, which was kind of at pinballs and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We also had a go kart track out there at that time. So and a restaurant, which is called the Blue Seas, best dollar hot dogs in town.
Mm-hmm.
But there was quite a bit to do out at Main Beach at that time.
Mm-hmm.
We used to also, that's Originally, that's where we had the fireworks out there, which shoot out over the ocean.
And we, I'm sorry, Brad.
The original start of the pre shrimp festival was started was actually in the 50s. Shrimp festival started in 64, but the pre we used to have a Miss Fernandina contest and things like that, and that was done at the beach and. Actually, Nassau Fertilizer contributed to that. Our flatbed truck, after we, you know, deodorized it, was used as the platform for the Miss Fernandina contest. You know, the girls would come out on, they would set that out, they would come out on that, you know, and people would be around that.
But, sure.
That was, that we, so we participated in that in a material way.
Was there a local teen hangout?
The Recreation Center. Was where after that was built in 56, they had a section there that they had basically a teen club in there where you could play 45s, which I'm sure everybody here knows what those are. A lot of these kids today wouldn't, but and you could play there. So in the, actually in the winter time, because with the northeasters in the cold weather at the beaches, you didn't go to the beach. People would go to the teen club.
What about beach driving?
If you could get your car on the beach, you could drive them. Actually, we had a there was a ramp at Main Beach. If you come straight down Atlantic, you go straight across, and you would go straight down. And you can still see. You have to look, but you can see the remains of that ramp. If you look just before you go into Sandy Bottoms, you can see a little bit of that ramp. But there was a ramp that went down on the beach there, and then we had the three. You could ride along the beach. Saddler Road there at Sliders was an entrance. Peters Point was another place you could get up off the beach, and of course American Beach. You could go down, drive all the way, and then you could drive all the way down to the south end and come back up and get on A1A. So you could ride down. I mean, and that a lot of people would do that. We go down, and you could take your car and ride down the beach. You could get on at Main Beach and actually go all the way to the south end.
Was there any beach racing done there?
You know, we did have beach racing. This is a little bit before my time, but we actually did have beach racing down the south end of the beach. They would have they would set up an oval track, and mainly at low tide, but they would race down there. And it, I think actually that went on up through the early 1950s. I was a little bit too young to go to that, but we did have that.
What was dating like?
Dating?
Did you date?
Well, you know, there were 2-to-1 girls, and some guy had 2 girls, so I didn't. I never did have a date. No. Well, we had you could go to the you could go to the Island Theater. I mean, it's not Island, but Island. I-L-A-N. And we always thought a gentleman by the name of Beach, who's actually was Beano Roberts' father-in-law, if you know Beano. Anyway, he owned the theater, which was a Quonset hut. It was a World War II Quonset hut that they had. It was actually located on the corner of 11th and Atlantic, right across from the water tower. Right in that corner there, where the Minute Market is. Right in that corner is where the Quonset Hut Theater was. And it was segregated. It upstairs was for blacks and downstairs for whites. It had an outside window for them to buy drinks, and the inside was for white. But it had two interesting features about it. One was it was one of the few places I knew. It actually had a room for mothers to take their children to, a soundproof room for mothers to take their children in with a big wide window so they could actually go in there and the kids could scream and you could you couldn't hear them unless you were sitting basically right beside it. But he had that, and then they had they actually had a stage where they did minstrel shows in this theater with a stage with a curtain, and they would have, they would put on minstrel shows, which if you're familiar, they had one minstrel show they didn't quite. It was actually a Perry Skimpy show, which they didn't know what it was until it actually got here. I think it had one performance, and then the mayor, who I think at that time was Bill Melton, decided, well, they better cancel that, but he needed to see it one more time to make sure. Now, I believe that's right, but I know it was the mayor that, but I'm not sure if I know they did see it one more time before they canceled it. But anyway,
let's ask about a couple of more spots. What about Fort Clinch? Was that active when you were a kid? A lot of stuff going on in there.
Actually, Fort Clinch was owned by the state, but they did very, very little with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the campground, what we call the river campground, was there. And the scouts and different people would camp out there. And at that time, what you'd do is just go, and you could just climb into the fort.
Mm-hmm.
Through the sand had built all the way up.
Yeah.
And you could climb through the loopholes in the fort. You could climb, mm-hmm. climb in and run around there and play and everything. And there was really, the fort was there, but they had not done too much to it.
What about the hotels on the island? I'm bringing you back downtown now a little bit. The hotels that were in existence at the time. Any recollections there?
Well, of course, the number one hotel here in town was the Keystone.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a working hotel through the 50s. And then basically it went out of business. And it was there until the 70s, in which somebody bought it, and our good friend Mr. Smiley Lee tore it down.
Hmm.
Now, if you ever want to put it back together again, get with Smiley, because he has all the doors, all the fixtures, all the fans, the only thing, and all the bricks.
Hmm.
In fact, if you want to see what the bricks are that were in the Keystone Hotel, go to the Minute Market there at 11th and Water Tower, and the facade of that is made from bricks from the Keystone Hotel.
Hmm. No kidding.
And the bricks were called, I'm trying to think of the name. It was a gray brick. Came from one particular clay foundation up in northeast Georgia, around Athens. It's not Athens gray, but it's... But anyway, that's the name of the brick, and if you go down and look at the Minute Mark, and you'll see it's a little bit darker brick. It's not the bright red brick. It's a little darker brick, and it's called a gray brick.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a little historical significance. The only other bricks I know are a gentleman named Jim Ewing has a walkway in the back of his house that's made from those bricks. But anyway.
Given the fact that most of your school years here were during the era of segregation, did Fernandina Beach High School have any occasions to interact with Peck High School, or were you completely separate in all of your athletics and band and all the kinds of things that kids usually do?
No, we were completely segregated. No integration at all. None. They had Peck High, which had their own athletic teams, their own band, and they were completely segregated. We didn't have. I mean, I probably integrated more with them at the Pudgy plant than most people did.
And did you ever go to any of the activities down at American Beach, like the clubs where a lot of the black musicians play?
No, that was completely segregated too. We would ride through there, and we would go down there. But I mean, it was a black beach. It was for them, and they had their own black beach, and that's where they went. Normally, in the summertime, you probably get anywhere from, on a weekend, you'd get 15 to 20 buses from primarily Macon, Georgia, and Atlanta, Georgia. And they would bring the blacks into there, and then they would spend the weekend, and then they would take them back out, on a Sunday. They'd come in on a Friday night and go back out on a Sunday. But we had our own beach at Main Beach, and so we stuck to that, and they stuck to theirs, and that's just the way it. That's just the way it was at the time.
Well, I was surprised to read that as late as 1960, there were still minstrel shows being held here in Fernandina Beach.
Yeah, I think so. There were a lot of minstrels and then the blackface, mm-hmm. and I thought, oh yeah, most assuredly, there were still shows here.
Ready? Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you a couple of seconds.
Charlie, this has been a great interview. On behalf of the museum, I would like to thank you for making a major contribution to share your life's experiences and those of your family and the contributions they made to Fernandina. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing your story.
Thank you. Thank you very much.